This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
The outcome of the marriage equality postal survey is announced. Today's forum aims to explore the question, should Australia vote yes, what legislation is likely to be proposed? So our speakers here come from a range of backgrounds and experience. Our first speaker will be Carolyn Evans. Carolyn is a professor and former dean of Melbourne Law School and an international recognised expert in religious freedom, including its intersection with other rights. She's a graduate of Melbourne and Oxford Law Schools and has taught at both those schools. She is the author or editor of 5 books on religion and law and dozens of chapters and articles, and has spoken on these topics around the world. Welcome, Carolyn.
Right, well, thank you for having me tonight. I'm the boring law bit at the start, the sort of the main course you have to have before the exciting desserts come afterwards. Just means if people are running late, they don't miss anything very interesting. So, assuming on Wednesday, after we've spent $122 million, we've had a debate that's ranged from the thoughtful to the downright toxic and hurtful, and we've spent months on these issues, assuming that the result comes out as a yes, and a reasonably strong yes. We can't necessarily say that's the case, but that's the assumption we're working on tonight. What is the legal and constitutional position? Well, it is exactly the same as if we'd done none of those things. Politically, of course, a lot of things change. But from a legal and a constitutional point of view, we have to go through precisely the same actions, and it now appears probably the same debate that we were always going to have to in the Parliament. So we need to get a bill through the House of Representatives and the Senate, and it needs to get royal assent, and it needs to come into force on a date to be determined by the Act. Nothing has actually changed through this process. This also means that we're going to see, and we're already seeing, that there is plenty of scope for debate to argue, well, the Australian people voted yes, but what did they really vote yes for? What exactly is the scope of the legislation? And people, it seems to me, want to have this debate almost as though all of this expense and hard work and heartache haven't happened. And that's particularly the case when it comes to the protection of religious freedoms. Now, there are two proposals out there at the moment, as most of you be aware. The Dean Smith proposal, which was put together by a cross-party group of parliamentarians, and it's been doing the rounds for quite some time now. And James Patterson has put his name on a bill that, again, has been put together by a more conservative group of parliamentarians. That came out today, which is terrific for all of us, because we've got it in the sort of 15 minutes I've had free today. I've tried to get on top of that, and I hope I won't lead you astray. Now, as I said in the introduction, I've been writing about religious freedom and its intersection with other rights, particularly non-discrimination rights, for a couple of decades. And I began with particular interest in the tension between religious freedom and women's rights, because, of course, a lot of traditional views of religion also have very definite views about the role of women and the limitations of that role. And while I'm largely going to be talking about what the different proposals set out in fairly factual terms, one point that I do want to come back to at the end is that I think the logic of a lot of the religious freedom exemptions, particularly for individuals, have a much wider set of implications and logics than just applying to same-sex marriage. I think this is part of a much broader religious conservative agenda, which is about undermining discrimination law more generally. Well, let's start with the basics. What are the minimal changes you would need if you wanted to change the Marriage Act to allow for same-sex marriage? Well, the most important and obvious one is to change the definition of marriage, which is currently between a man and a woman, to be between two people, and to get rid of that particularly obnoxious section which says at a marriage ceremony you have to say that. You just delete that section altogether. You probably would need to recognise foreign marriages on the same basis as you do heterosexual marriages. And then there are a whole bunch of relatively technical considerations around gender-neutral language, military marriages and all those sort of things. But let's not get too fussed about those details. That's really the nub of it. That's the minimum, and in my view, that would actually work quite well. The Marriage Act already gives quite a lot of capacity for religious ministers to refuse to marry people on the basis of their religious beliefs. Catholic priests are not required to marry divorced couples. If your religion requires that banns are read and it takes several months to do that, you can't be forced to simply marry people the next week. So there's already quite a lot of protection, for religious ministers at least. But in both the Smith and the Patterson bills, and it's probably just a political necessity, there is a more clear and defined set of exemptions for religious ministers to say that they do not have to celebrate religious marriages. And it's not restricted to same-sex marriages, it's any marriage that doesn't conform with the tenets of their religion. Then there's the issue of civil celebrants. The Smith bill allows some civil celebrants to be exempted from having to perform marriages that don't conform with their religious beliefs, largely a group of existing and ministers of religion who don't fall into the general category of ministers of religion. The Smith bill creates a new class of civil celebrant called the traditional marriage celebrant, which might be a minister of religion but might just be a person with a strong religious or conscientious objection. It's not limited to just religious objections. So a commitment to traditional marriage is all that's required there. You know, this is the sort of thing on which reasonable minds have differed across different countries. The Smith bill then puts into the Marriage Act an exemption for religious bodies in respect to not participating in marriage directly or incidentally. So this is the bit that protects religious bodies from having to hire the parish hall, or if they're running a flower business or a cake shop, not having to provide for marriages that don't conform with their teachings. It uses almost exactly the same language that the current Sex Discrimination Act does. It's probably, in fact, not necessary. I think it basically doesn't give any more and doesn't give any less rights to religious organisations for the most part. Again, it's probably politically sensible. But there's an extra provision at the end there that's a little bit ambiguous that says that the reasons that are given in the Sex Discrimination Act for being able to act in conformity with your religious beliefs are not exclusive, that it could go further. I think that's perhaps ambiguous and unhelpful. So the Smith Act largely finishes there, and there are various other technical amendments, and the Patterson Act reflects a lot of them as well. The Patterson Bill, on the other hand, goes further. It goes a lot further. It provides protections of various kinds for both religious or conscientious individuals and organisations, and it introduces the concept of two types of belief. One is a relevant belief, and the other is a relevant marriage belief. The narrower of the two is largely about marriage being a traditional marriage between a man and a woman, but the more expansive covers quite a number of things, and you can have these beliefs either altogether or any one of them is sufficient. It includes that the family unit is fundamental and involves a man and a woman raising children, that sexual relationships are only for married couples, that in most cases, and this is to quote the Act, the normative state of gender is binary and can be determined in most cases at birth. And again, to quote the Act, that gender difference and complementarity of men and women is inherent and a fundamental feature of human society. And we travel quite a long way from marriage there. So individuals have a right to speak in favour of all of those beliefs, and the legislation protects them from claims in either discrimination law or vilification law. They also have a right to refuse services, both directly and indirectly, in relation to same-sex marriages, as compared to the Smith Bill, which only allows religious organisations that exemption. They have the right to withdraw their children from classes on sexual education if the class doesn't conform with their religious or conscientious belief. People holding the relevant belief cannot be discriminated against on the basis of that belief. And the Commonwealth is also prohibited from discriminating, in this case just against an organisation, in the allocation of funding because that organisation has a traditional marriage belief, or from denying charitable status from an organisation on that ground. There's a new criminal offence of victimisation of people on the basis of their belief, and also a civil action. That's a lot of work for the Marriage Act, right? It does seem to go well beyond the usual purposes that we tend to think of as Marriage Acts covering. You know, who can be married, who can marry them, what the forms are, how you have to register. That's what we normally see. And it's basically saying there can be no recognition of same-sex marriage till every concern that has come up in any jurisdiction which has dealt with any of these issues anywhere in the world is comprehensively dealt with and dealt with in favour of religious organisations and individuals. It departs from the traditional Australian approach to discrimination law. Now, that approach has been to give in global terms, really quite generous protections to religious organisations with respect to discrimination in employment and service provision and so forth, and many people would contest even those exemptions. But on the whole, it doesn't give exemptions to people to act against the law, individuals to act against the law, because of their religious or conscientious belief. Conscientious objection is a very limited class, because we don't want the law to become a choose-your-own-adventure. You know, I like this bit, I'll comply with that. I'm not so fond of that bit, I won't comply with that. And that, you know, is effectively what you're doing when you're saying individuals are exempted from discrimination law. Now, I do want to say that I don't treat lightly the notion that we should force individuals through the mechanism of law to act against their conscience. Right? I actually think that's something the law should only do when there are very weighty reasons to do so. You know, it is actually incredibly important to people to be able to act, as a general rule, in compliance with their conscience. And I also think we need to be very careful about the law restricting free speech, even speech that's sometimes harmful or hurtful, because I am wary about trusting the state interfering in what people can say. You know, I think that is a dangerous precedent. But I think that two important issues have been lost in the claim that same-sex marriage is a great threat to religious freedom. The first is that there is a serious countervailing reason for restricting religious freedom in this case, which is a commitment to equality. This is not, as sometimes the rhetoric seems to suggest, a case where religious freedom is being restricted for no terribly good reason, or a light or a trivial or a dangerous reason. And I've spoken out against the restriction of religious freedom by governments, which happens, for those reasons. But this is about the protection of equality. And equality is another serious human right. While it's been wrapped up in a lot of pleasantries and sophistries, the bottom line is the Paterson Law wants to give a very wide range of individuals the right to say, we don't serve your type here. Yeah? And that is something that the law will say is legitimate. It will say it with respect to a restricted area, same-sex marriage in this case, but that is a line that's been used by a lot of deeply unpleasant people throughout history, not just with respect, of course, to sexual orientation, but race, sex, all sorts of things, and it's often been said in the name of a religious belief. The second is that most of this is only tangentially, at best, related to same-sex marriage. Many of the issues raised in the Paterson Bill would be live ones regardless of whether the Marriage Act was changed or not. They're not at an issue because of same-sex marriage per se, but because our society is changing from one where traditional religious values around sex and sexuality, the role of men, the role of women, no longer have the dominance they once had, and in which equality and sexual freedom have much stronger social support. That shift of values and the clashes that it gives rise to existed well before any changes to the Marriage Act and will continue to exist whether or not changes to the Marriage Act go through. To delay reflecting the views of Australians on same-sex marriage until these conflicts are comprehensively won by one side or the other, or some mythical consensus can be reached, is, in my view, untenable. In conclusion, the changes that are needed to bring about the legal changes to same-sex marriage are relatively simple. I think the Smith Bill is a pretty good start in balancing what are some legitimate interests and concerns of religious groups with those who wish to see robust protection on equal terms for all couples who wish to marry. While the notion that we should protect religious conscience of the individual forced against their will to provide flowers or cakes to a wedding has appealed to some people, particularly when conveyed in a certain way, I'm wary, and I very much hope that in this atmosphere of political turmoil and compromise, we don't accept this as the political compromise to get the legislation through. The logic once accepted here is quite extensive. If it's harmful to require a florist to provide flowers for a wedding that offends his religious beliefs, well, it's probably equally reasonable to say he shouldn't have to hire a woman if his religion tells him that a woman's place is in the home and she shouldn't be employed. It's probably equally reasonable for him to refuse to serve somebody he considers a heretic and whose views offend him. It's probably equally reasonable to say he doesn't believe in interracial marriage and to refuse to serve a couple who wish to marry from different races. I'm yet to see a convincing explanation about what is distinctive in same-sex marriage that makes it deserving of more protection for religious freedom, unless you consider it a second-class form of equality. And I don't think the law should recognise second-form classes of equality. And to be honest, while most are not explicit about it yet, I think many of those pushing for the exemptions would agree, because in my experience of these debates over the years, this is part of the longer-term agenda for religious conservative groups. Many religions have been very sceptical about or hostile to many forms of equality, preferring that both their own organisations and members be able to act in accord with their conscience. Many religious groups came out against the Equal Pay Act, many religious groups came out against the Sex Discrimination Act, and many, of course, have a very honourable track record in this regard. The Paterson Bill, in my view, is not the end of a political debate, something we might sort of simply have to put up with in order to get a particular end through, but the thin edge of a tactical wedge that will then be replicated across as many areas of discrimination as there's political will for. In this respect, and perhaps this respect only, those who say that changes to the Marriage Act to reflect same-sex marriage is about much more than just same-sex marriage are probably right. And the decisions that we make in this context about where the permissible boundaries of exemptions from discrimination lie are both incredibly important in their own right and also have significant implications for a range of other areas. Thank you.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.